I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the fourth edition of the Reform Party podcast. So far, the feedback from I've been getting on the podcast is it's been going very well. The stats are good and so on. The one bit of negative feedback I've had is that it's a little bit like talking to friends because you're speaking to people in the party who don't disagree about things, so there's not enough edge to it. So today I'm going to reverse that because I'm going to talk to a friend, but I'm going to talk to a friend who I know has got some different views about reform than I do. So it may be more interesting, hopefully. Anyway, I'd like to introduce Malcolm Saunders.
Hi, Ken.
Welcome. Right, perhaps we usually just start off by getting a little bit of biographical background detail from you. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? What have you done in life?
Hi. Was born and grew up in what is now Oxfordshire. It was Berkshire at the time, but they mess around with boundaries. I was for most of my growing up years in Witney in Oxfordshire, small market town, quite pleasant. I came into politics when I was 15, height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We all thought the world was going to end by the incompetence of the politicians handling the issue and the mutually assured destruction philosophy of the time. And I certainly believed that destruction really meant that. I went on an order must and march. From that, I became aware of all sorts of things that I hadn't before. Understandably, at age of 15, I joined the CND and the anti-apartheid movement, which was a terrible injustice at that time around massacres of Sharpeville. It gave me a very acute feeling about the wrongs of the world. And I became a Marxist as a consequence of that. It seemed like the solution. You know, we're going to get rid of class exploitation. Mine was a very working class home. As far as I could see, the workers were being exploited. And it was a natural progression. It took me many years after that to work out that Marx
maybe
was wrong.
Maybe you had made a mistake.
I'd made a mistake, quite a big one. Marx was wrong about economics. The labour theory of value doesn't work. It's only markets that work. You can't plan economies. It's impossible. Mm. And Khrushchev and his successors were failing time after time after time. A brutal oppression in every communist regime that existed. And of course, they collapsed because none of it.
Although not till quite a while later.
A lot later. And it took me a long time as well. As I said, started out at 15. I was well into my 30s.
And what did you do when you left school?
Worked in a whole series of manual jobs. Went from one to another. It was an easy time. To go from one job to another. I was on building sites and in shops and nothing suited. I was working in a limestone quarry, extracting gravel, and the Oxfordshire area is ideal for pea grit, they call it, very small pebbles, which are heated up, cooked, and ground down into a fine white powder, which is the undersurface of all of our roads.
Right.
So that was what was going on there. And one winter morning of February, probably, the yard was very, very iced up, and it was always underwater. So we ran diesel pumps to pump the water away. I was swinging the handle to start a diesel pump. The engine fired, and instead of the handle dropping down as it should, with a little lip, it was frozen.
Mm.
So the handle swung round with the engine, whacked my knee, and caused me an injury that I lived with ever after.
you still have the limp.
I still have the limp.
And these injuries don't get any easier, I think, with age, do they?
They're getting worse. Getting worse and worse. So I recovered well enough. Well, a couple of botched operations, but recovered enough after that to actually get into the fire service later. But before that happened, I realised I couldn't do manual work.
But you went to Oxford University?
I did.
Yeah. How did that come about?
After the knee injury, I'd got no qualifications, didn't do any work at school, left school at 15. I went to a grammar school, but I thought they were poor, and the quality of what I was being taught was boring and didn't engage me at all. I joined a boxing club and was spending all my time on physical things, which were a waste of life, really. But so I had nothing, and that's why I'd been in labouring jobs or working in shops. I applied while I was injured and getting
so operation. What age were you at this point?
I was 25. Yeah, 1973. 25, I applied to Ruskin College at Oxford, which is a college for people who don't have any academic qualifications, right, who want to resume their education, and supported by the trade union movement and others. I applied for that, got in, did a two-year diploma course there, applied to Worcester College, Oxford University, got in there, and did a degree in philosophy, politics and economics.
I'll let you off. Yeah, generally I'm not very keen on people who do PPE at university, but I'll let you off.
It was a great time, actually.
Mm.
Very, very interesting, and not at all what I expected, because I didn't know anything about the university. I expected it to be class-ridden, and that I was going to be the butt of... being a minority working class kid among a load of toffs who had been to public school. Well, they were all there.
Mm.
But the debate that I got engaged in the student union, the junior common room, as it's called in Oxford University, I could more than hold my own.
Mm.
So that was no problem at all. But the education was actually very high quality. It's a one-to-one tutorial system. So I was trying to argue my politics and my economics with people who did it every day of their lives. They were leaders in their field. And just to try to maintain a bit of self-respect, I had to do work.
So you've now discovered that universities value intellect much more than they value anything else.
Absolutely.
Was that part of the reason that the sort of Marxist shackles started to fall away?
They started to fall away because I couldn't win the arguments. It took a long time after that before, you know, I broke my whole misunderstanding of politics. But I was trying to argue a Marxist economy and a planned economy, and you know, utter rubbish. And of course, I got nowhere, I got defeated. But I was getting defeated by Keynesians, who I later found out to be wrong as well.
As wrong as you are.
They were. Yeah. They were as wrong as I was. But it was tough in the right way. What had happened at school was we were given a history which was incredibly biased. We were given literature that didn't interest me and all this sort of stuff, and by people who weren't that adequate, to be honest. What I faced at university was people who were very clever. They could argue well. They knew a great deal because they're doing it all their lives, every day of their life. They've got nothing else to do, have they? And that was challenging, interesting, fascinating. And it's led me on to lifelong learning. You know, I can't remember any of it anymore. But, it ignited a passion.
Mm. Well, that's what universities are supposed to do, isn't it?
Exactly.
And yep. So that's good.
If only they all did it.
So when you left university, did you join the fire service right away?
Not absolutely right away. I did a bit of teaching of industrial law to adults in peripheral bits of the university. It bored me stupid.
Mm.
Couldn't stand it. I am a very physical, practical kind of person. And in teaching of that kind anyway, what you're doing is repeating yourself day after day after day.
I've always thought that that's one of the things that with technology these days, why do we still have the same kind of modes of education as we did 50 years ago? I mean, it used to be that you would go to university and you would have a lecturer who would effectively deliver the same lecture year after year after year to a new class. Now, why does anybody want to do that? I mean, you now have access through YouTube or the internet to the very best minds, not in Oxford, but in the world.
Hmm.
And why are people not using the online lectures effectively to educate themselves?
Absolutely. Universities can't survive in the form that they are. They're too expensive.
Hmm.
They don't meet people's actual needs in life. As you say, all of the world's knowledge is instantly available to everybody who wants to find it.
You don't have to go to the library anymore and look it up. It's all there at your fingertips.
Yeah. And you find it precisely, don't you? You have an issue you want information about and you go specifically to that issue.
Mm.
You don't read a stack of books where there's 90% other than what you need to know and just the little bit that you want, which is lost among it.
Just while we're on that, and it just reminded me, one thing I was going to talk to you about, I would ask you about this. Have you downloaded DeepSeek yet?
I haven't. I will.
I know you will. That's why I wondered if you got it yet. I've finally beaten you on something.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating, the effect on the financial market.
Ah, yes, exactly. I had a bit of money in the NASDAQ. It didn't go very well last week.
No, it wouldn't.
But it is a remarkable story. How true it is in terms of the amount of money that they spent to do it, I've no idea. But if it is true, it's like another move forward. It's like when the personal computer was first invented. That's the effect it's going to have.
Yeah.
Although I believe that if you ask it if Taiwan is a country, it doesn't do so well.
No. And if you want to know something about what happened in Tiananmen Square, you'll get nothing. Yes, it demonstrates that artificial intelligence is still human-influenced and human-manipulated, and it will continue to be. The algorithms carry all of the biases and prejudices of the people who write them. But when AI becomes truly self-learning and it moves beyond algorithms to forming its own associations wholly independently, then something very dramatic is going to happen.
I mean, my understanding is that the way that they managed to do it so cheaply is that it's they have a main hub, which is the one which uses all the power and the energy to do it, and then they have peripheral hubs.
Yes.
Who all are trained by the main hub So it's almost like a training exercise going out the way. Is that you understand it?
I think that's what I understand as well. I'm sure we're not being told the truth or the whole truth about how the development happened, and I suspect it's more expensive and more complicated than is being suggested. But that does seem to be the model, and it seems to be right, and it's sort of how the brain works, that it holds memories and information, knowledge and opinions, all in different parts of the brain, and it draws from them.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
Right, so let's go back to what, 1980, is it? When what time did you leave uni and start working?
77 I left university, 78 I joined the fire service after this year or so of lecturing. Got the mickey taken out of me for being an Oxford University graduate.
So you were doing the reverse?
Quite the opposite to what I had been before.
You've not had an easy life, Malcolm.
It's very easy. I became the butt of a few jokes, good-humoured ones, perfectly nice environment. I was the prof suddenly.
The prof,
But, you know, it was practical. So I got on perfectly well in the fire service. It went very well. And as you know, I then progressed on through that, moved to different areas.
And finally landed in Merseyside.
Finally landed in Merseyside, via, after Oxford, Birmingham, West Yorkshire, and then Merseyside,
Am I right in saying the appointment was made by a politician?
Yes, that's right.
Is it Whitehead?
There was a fire committee at the time. Peter Dabb was the chair of the committee, and I was appointed after a sort of two-day interview with all sorts of processes by a group of people from the fire committee. Politicians, as you say, local government councillors.
This is from Liverpool mainly?
Mainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. The very clear brief that they needed me to sort out the gross overspending and appalling waste, which was a hangover from the Derek Hatton years, 20 years previously, a long, long time, when he had accepted everything that the Fire Brigades Union asked for.
Well, he was in the Fire Brigade, wasn't he?
He had been, briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one, Terry Fields, was he not ex-fire?
Yeah. Yeah. He was ex-fire service as well, militant, but landlord later. More suited to him.
Suited him better, yeah. We better not watch, we're being defamatory here. But going back to Derek Hatton, I see that he is still involved in Liverpool. He's one of the people who has been arrested along with Joe Anderson in this fraud investigation. So,
yeah, I don't think they've ever been charged with anything.
They haven't, but the police investigation is now going on for about 4 years.
Yes.
And politicians have now, I think it was at Heseltine the other day, poked his head above the parapet and said, you know, what's going on with this? Is anybody ever going to get charged?
Probably not. But yeah, I know little about that. But yes, you're right, he's still involved. The havoc he created was appalling. What he did was that he changed all of the part-time fire stations to full-time so that it gave the FBU a lot more members for no other reason than that. And it cost millions and millions every year. And as I say, the brief I was given was to try to sort this mess out and to do other modernisations. Fire service is very essential, obviously, it's very important, but it's very resistant to change, and it's
particularly when you've got the FBU, which is, I mean, what is it? Is it Stalinist or Trotskyist or Leninist? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's Marxist of all those varieties,
right?
And it has been for many years, and It operates, unfortunately, in a very aggressive way. There's 100% membership of the FPU among firefighters.
And all the votes are carried by 100% to nothing.
They are. They are. That's right. I mean, there's no official closed shop, but it's impossible to not be a member.
Mm. Yeah. And when you were taken on, who was it that effectively gave you this mandate?
Well, the fire committee, officially, but right. It was led by Peter, who had
was there not a Westminster politician involved in terms of because this came after there had been a series of fires of strikes the previous year, and the Green Goddesses were out and so on. Was there not a political objective coming from Westminster that this needed to be sorted out and they needed somebody to get their foot in the door and start to resolve it?
That's what they claimed. They said that they wanted it. They wanted change.
And who specifically?
Well, it wasn't consistent. It changed over and over. The fire service minister, who's a genius minister in the Home Office at that time, I can't even remember the name of it.
But there was a national political imperative.
To cut costs, to improve efficiency, and to modernise the service, which was entirely white male. There was, a handful
of DEI.
Handful of exceptions to that. Yeah, sort of pre-DEI, as you say. There was no attempt to do positive discrimination or anything like that, but the mould of sons of firefighters becoming firefighters was what was seen to be wrong. Mm. It was nepotistic, and it was.
Yeah.
So I tried to break that. I tried to cut the appalling overstaffing, overspending. So I immediately stopped recruitment. Cut out some departments and started working through.
So you did an Elon Musk?
Yes, I did. And the reaction I got, you'll know, I faced strikes and a very, very high level of aggression associated with those strikes.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very, very intimidatory atmosphere.
Yes, extraordinarily so. I think to the extent that probably wouldn't be understood or recognised outside of the fire service very much. For example, the Fire Brigades Union has a magazine, and they did a cartoon of my bed with a horse's head in it, which everybody knows is the old mafia warning that you're going to be feeding the fishes shortly.
Yeah.
And then a little after that, they lined the route from my house to my office with wanted posters on telegraph poles and light standards with my face and wanted. It's the old Wild West, dead or alive thing.
The thing hasn't changed at all. It's exactly the same.
It is the same, yeah.
So do we just accept that something that's never going to change?
I hope it's going to change. I've not seen change. What has happened since I got shoved out, and perhaps we'll cover that in just a minute, is that they have reduced the numbers of firefighters by a fair bit. Nothing like as much as they needed to, or I would have done had I had the chance to carry on and go through with the full scheme.
Mm. Do you think if we got in power that reform could do anything about it?
It's a hard one to answer, isn't it? You'd have to break the stranglehold
of the union.
Of the union. What that would involve is that you'd certainly have a loss of service while they put up.
What about? I mean, I understand it's not Green Goddesses anymore, but the army still have got backup fire vehicles, haven't they?
The Army have got firefighting capability, the Air Force even more so, because they cover air
How about moving to some kind of hybrid force where you effectively used the Army, or presumably trained them up a bit more, got them some more vehicles, use them to fight fires?
I don't think there are enough of them or in the right places.
You could train some more.
You could train more. Whether it's a good idea to have a military force engaged in coming around to people's houses to put out fires and things like that, not completely sure. I think...
That's not exactly a customer service role, is it? I mean, if your house is on fire, you're not really too worried about who comes and puts it out as long as somebody does.
In my view, it would be better put out to contract, which would cause even more outrage, I suspect.
we'll come onto those in a while with the local authority.
Well, prisons have gone out to contract and loads of other things which people once believed could only be provided by the state.
I promised the viewers when we started that this conversation would have a little more edge to it than some of the ones I've had previously. So I think we probably need to get on and fulfil that now. What do you think of the things that Donald Trump did last week?
Well, it was frenetic, wasn't it, for a first week of the presidency, and typical to his personality, it was all over the place. He bothers me. He's not a stable character. He's the choice of the American people, and that has to be accepted. I certainly accept that that's the case, and we all have to live with that. As to what he did, he had no chance to think any depth about any of it, did he? I think he did some dreadful things. For example, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, a whole lot of others, still coming out, like General Milley, yesterday, having their security withdrawn was an invitation to kill them. That is terrible. It's disgraceful. It shows a vindictive streak in Trump, which didn't ought to be president in somebody who's leading the most powerful country in the world. When it comes to things like conflicts in the Middle East, when he's talked about clearing out Gaza, sending all its residents to Egypt or Jordan, he just doesn't understand what he's doing. It would be called ethnic cleansing anywhere else. And it's just accepting an absurd set of beliefs by Zionists and by Christian nationalists and going along with them. It can't happen, it won't happen, but that he thinks he can decree it is a bit worrying. But as to the other stuff, I mean, the cutting of spending and all of that, I'm with.
Mm.
And it's fine. And he'll hit a lot of roadblocks, just as I did when I tried to.
So you're saying that the domestic things that he's done, you're all in favour of?
I'm with deregulation of business. I'm with cutting spending and waste. That's all fine.
You're with completely clearing out all the diversity, equity, inclusion people in government.
Yeah, they're a parasitic burden on. All of the institutions.
So really your quarrel with Trump really is, first of all, his personality, which I think a lot of people share that, but in a sense, being president of the United States is not really, his personality is not that important. What's important is what he does. Now, being a strong man, as he clearly is, when he was in power in 2016, his initiatives in the Middle East were actually very effective and had some very good positive results, do you think?
Not much. Well, the Abraham Accords are what acclaimed as being his achievement. What did they achieve? Nothing of substance. Got the UAE and one other state to recognise Liverpool.
Saudi Arabia, wasn't it?
No. No, very definitely not. The objective was to get Saudi Arabia to recognise Israel, which they declined to do and they never will, so long as there is no Palestinian state that they find acceptable. Even then, I'm not convinced that they will. No, it didn't really achieve very much. It was lauded a great deal.
Mm.
but it didn't.
So, on other foreign policy issues, and we had a bit of a falling out a couple of weeks ago with regard to Ukraine, and you had the cheek to fact check me, didn't you? Mm. And a couple of things. And unfortunately, you were correct on both of them. But going on more broadly, I think, do you think that Trump is going to cut the money?
Not sure that he will. He might. If he does, that will cripple Ukraine's ability to resist the Russian occupation. It would be a very wrong thing to do. Trump seems to have started to change his language, though. He's been hostile to Putin a few times recently. But at the same time, he says that Zelensky should have surrendered to Russia. So there's the contradiction that you see all the time. You say it's not his personality that matters, it's what he does. Mm. But of course, his personality directs his actions. And he does these contradictory things like I've just described. The invasion of Ukraine didn't happen in February 2022. It happened at the same time as the annexation of Crimea in 2014, when Putin sent troops into Luhansk and Donetsk, which are collectively called the Donbas region of Ukraine. He sent them in disguised as being domestic insurgents against Kyiv.
Yeah, there were two parties, actually, wasn't there? There were proxy, Putin yes. proxy parties, but there were parties in the area.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There were Russian speakers and Russian-speaking parties who didn't like to be ruled from Kyiv.
Was part of the thing, though, at that time, that not that these parties would effectively have create a certain amount of self-determination for Donbass?
Well, they'd already had a fairly high degree of autonomy, and they wanted complete separation. I mean, they should have full autonomy, in my view. But the difficulty is that Putin has the view, which is the same view as Hitler, actually, though, you know, it's not great to make these comparisons, and I don't compare him completely, but Hitler's view was that German speakers were Germans. Mm. And Putin's view is that Russian speakers are Russians. They're not. You know, Austria isn't Germany. Sudetenland isn't Germany. And Moldova isn't Germany. It isn't Russia. And the Donbass isn't Russia. And he is not allowed to invade a sovereign country militarily.
I mean, I think where we disagree a little bit about this is in the historical build-up to it. And also, I mean, we both agree that it's geopolitical, that you've got a big, powerful state in Russia who are exerting their influence wherever they can. And you can guarantee that in, for example, the Orange Revolution that happened after in 2014, I think, something like yeah. that, that both the KGB were involved. But I'm certain, I think I saw a figure the other day, 65 million the CIA were also involved. So I mean, the whole thing is it's power by proxy, isn't it?
It is power by proxy. I don't defend America and CIA involvement any more than I accept. KGB doesn't exist anymore, by the way, it's the FSB. But
was it KBG at that time?
No.
Fact checked again.
Doesn't make any difference. No, it's their intelligence yeah. services. Yes, they meddle. Both of them meddle. So does Britain. Mm. And they shouldn't.
And so should we be getting involved in supporting this proxy war? Because I look at what's happened in Ukraine, and it's a bit like all the other conflicts, all the other wars that you can ever think about. That at the end of the day, there's a million people have died there, a million young men who have yeah. gone to their deaths. For what? Because America and Russia want to play games with each other?
Yeah. The answer is no, we shouldn't get involved. There's no reason why we shouldn't express our support for one side or the other, but we shouldn't and mustn't be involved. We've been involved too much. We shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And that applies everywhere. It applies in the Middle East as much as it does in Ukraine. We should be looking to Britain looking after itself only in the sense of being well protected and well defended about against being bullied by others, not involving ourselves in the disputes elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, we seem to have got a bit of agreement on that at last. Going to the other things that Trump did last week, I think we'll probably have some pretty easy wins here. You're happy with him withdrawing from the World Health Organization?
Yeah, I don't think it matters, but yeah, I'm happy with it.
Well, it would matter if the WHO declared a pandemic here and told us what we had to do.
What I think is it'll probably get dragged back into it.
Well, that's why
it doesn't matter.
And you're happy that he finally came out of the Paris Climate Accord?
Oh, yeah.
And are you happy that with his strategy in America to drill, baby, drill, to extract as much fossil fuels as he can from the country?
Well, he shouldn't be telling them to go and do it, and he shouldn't be stopping them from going and doing it. The market should get on with providing the energy which is needed. And it needs to provide it responsibly. There are constraints on every industry, and they should do it cleanly, properly, safely.
Yeah.
The market should function.
But broadly speaking, you're not against them doing it.
No.
And that's also bound to have an effect here. I mean, we were talking about the effect it's going to have on the UK net zero policies, which seems to me are falling apart in any case.
The net zero policies are unachievable and they shouldn't be there at all. They don't make sense.
Mm.
What is important and necessary for America and for us is that we should have diverse sources of energy and not be dependent on one or on any external suppliers as far as possible. So, yeah, we should have a variety. We should have nuclear. We should have so-called renewables, whether it's wind or wave power or whatever else it is. We should have whatever we need to meet our energy consumption.
Here's one that I think we are going to hopefully fall out over. You won't be happy with Trump having introduced border controls on the Mexican border, and you certainly won't be happier with him having instructed that illegals be rounded up and sent back to their countries of origin.
I'm not happy with it at all. It's cruel and unnecessary. Worse than unnecessary, America needs that labour. And they'll have to have it one way or another. What I find absolutely deplorable is the expansionist objectives that Trump, with his threats to Greenland, to Panama, even to Canada, that he wants to make America larger, just like Putin. Exactly the same as his role model. He's wrong and upsetting to me that he's behaving in such a way. And it's getting worse.
But opening
of Guantanamo Bay as a possibility.
Sending back illegal migrants to the country of origin was not quite the same as that, is it?
It's part of the whole same thing, isn't it? It's saying that we as Americans want to be pure and big and taking over control of more and more. And these people are not Americans. And he goes on to say much worse, doesn't he? He says they're criminals, rapists, lunatics. And
some are.
And some Americans are as well. True. And some British are. And everybody else, you know. That's a nonsense argument.
So, extrapolating from that, if you're unhappy with them sending, if America needs the labour, as you said, and he obviously doesn't think it does, and he's the president, so he's entitled to act on that. Yeah. But does the UK need the labour of the illegal migrants who are coming across the channel?
The UK needs migrant labour.
Mm, that's not what I asked.
No, I know. But you deliberately...
are you not supposed to answer the question?
You distorted the issue deliberately.
Well, no, there's two issues. You have legal migration and you have illegal migration. So what you're saying is you want to take the two separately.
They have to be taken separately.
I'm happy to do that.
The problem is that we have no routes of legal migration to meet the needs of the country. We're an ageing population. We're full of people like me who are past it for being productive. And we need to provide our health care, our elderly care, to provide all of the things we like and want, the whole of the hospitality industry, the people who pack and deliver our foods. We don't have those from the indigenous population. We can't avoid that fact. So we have to provide means of legal immigration to meet that need, to meet what the market demands.
I couldn't agree more. I think I made the very same point in the podcast last week.
Illegal migrant numbers are very, very small. They need to be dealt with because it's tragic. Mm. People die trying to get into the country illegally. And when people come to seek asylum, and some of them are genuinely fleeing horrible persecution, we prevent them from working. We make it impossible for them to do anything other than to be either on benefits or working in the
black economy.
Black economy.
Yep.
Doesn't make sense.
I absolutely agree with you. But I mean, at the end of the day, they're coming. And are you in favour of proposals to stop them coming?
I'm certainly in favour of ways of...
Are you happy that we leave the ECHR? That we get, no. We instruct our Navy to push them back?
We shouldn't leave the ECHR.
Why not?
Because it has a function to perform. We were founder members of it. It's not the EU, which some people imagine it to
but
be.
But it's not the same organisation that we founded, though, is it?
It's got British judges on it.
But it's got a lot of European judges on it.
Of course
and
it has,
the European
because it's a European body.
Yeah, but I mean, what you find is that the judiciary have all moved way to the left from the sort of judges that we had at the time we founded it, and so therefore anything that they don't like, they'll throw out, and so it hamstrings us at every turn.
Well, judges are judges. They're not left-wing or right-wing. Well,
But I'm not in favour of unelected people controlling our policy.
Well, electing judges is something that I would be very hostile to.
No, but I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is get them out of the thing altogether. Don't involve them.
Hmm. Yeah, I disagree. We need judicial bodies to make judgments about fundamental issues of not being persecuted, because some governments do.
Could we not have a Bill of Rights to stop that?
Yes, we could, and we don't have.
No, but if we did have, would you be happy coming out of the ECHR? Just to be clear, that is Reform's policy. We come out of the ECHR and we replace it with a Bill of Rights.
I would be happy with a framework of law which worked. We don't have such a thing. We don't have a written constitution or a Bill of Rights.
Okay. What other of to let people understand their background, we have been friends for a long number of years, and we've always had interesting, I think, political discussions. But up until about 4 or 5 years ago, we wouldn't have been very good in this podcast because we agreed with each other on almost everything.
Mm.
Since I became involved with with Reform about 5 years ago, we now disagree on quite a few things. So what of the other Reform policies that we have do you disagree with?
Well, Reform's a nationalist party.
So just the fact that it's nationalist?
Well, that determines its approach to most other things. It starts out from a position that Britain should be largely insular. It should keep other people out, immigration is a huge part of what reform is, that it should regard Britain and its institutions as in some way better than others.
And do you not think that the British institutions are very good, or have been very good, and that we have, as we exported them in the days of empire, that we have done a lot of good throughout the world in terms of giving people what were institutions first formed in the UK?
No. I think our institutions are not particularly good. If you look at what our institutions are, we have, as I said, no constitution. We play it by ear. It buffets along from one generation to another and modifies itself. We've got a church tied up in the state, bishops as lawmakers, a state religion, absolutely disgraceful. The judiciary doesn't work very well at all. Trials by jury, which lots of other countries have taken from us, is hopeless, doesn't work at all. Representative democracy with a first past the post system is an outrage. The reason that reform only has a handful of MPs is because of that system. It institutionalizes the two coalitions that are Labour and Tory to stay in power forever, although they may have to moderate themselves a little bit with a coalition here or there, or they may have to give millions upon millions to unionists in Northern Ireland to stay in power. It's hopelessly incompetent. We don't have anything worthwhile to brag about to the world in any of those institutions. And if we come on to the other parts of this Britishness that we're proud of and best in the world stuff, what have we got? NHS? It's the biggest one, isn't it? The biggest monstrosity of all. A huge bureaucracy from which people are able to steal millions upon millions because they don't know what's happening within it. There's vast waste where people create a little empire for themselves. They found another condition or something that they can specialise in and then start to employ people and be the boss of. It's a monster. It doesn't work. We have poorer health outcomes than most of the developed world.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, we're now moving back onto to territory where I'm afraid we do agree. how do you think Labour are doing at the minute?
Terrible. Absolutely incompetent.
And where do you think the UK is going?
Well, it's going into economic decline. We will have no growth or worse growth than almost all other comparable countries. The United States looks like it will grow and grow as it has been doing for some time.
And is the obvious disparity between what's going to happen in the US, because it is going to be, despite the Nasdaq going down the other day, it is because it's actually bounced back, it's going to become richer and richer.
Yeah.
And we, by contrast, are going to become poorer and poorer. And that's going to be obvious to not only everybody in the world, but it's going to be obvious to the British public, isn't it?
It must become obvious, mustn't it? I mean, the Rachel Reeves budget, which put a massive increase in national insurance onto businesses, is already showing in that companies are shedding labour at a huge rate.
Mm.
We're seeing it at the moment in the banks and the large hospitality companies, but it will spread because people can't afford to employ in those situations. They're doing the same with business rates, which are going up. They're destroying small business, particularly the big, the very big ones, will be able to shift over to AI-provided services and dispense with many of their workforce, but small businesses will be driven out.
Absolutely. Yep. The other thing is that What do you think is going to happen when the bond markets look at where they're going to invest, where they're going to lend money to? When they look, when they look at America and they see a country with huge natural resources, exploiting them, getting richer and richer, and they look at the UK, a country with very little natural resources and increasingly not even any industrial base. I mean, I think we've got one steelworks left in the whole country. Where do you think bond markets are going to want to lend their money? And how long before they turn around to the UK and say, I'm sorry, you know, we're not going to lend to you?
Money will go where a return is going to be obtained from money. It can't do anything else. And they're not going to get the return in the British economy with what the Labour government is doing at the moment. Labour doesn't understand business. Rachel Reeves certainly doesn't. And a combination of the Chancellor hitting small business in the way that she has, and Angela Rayner fortifying what she calls employment rights, but really means giving power to trade unions, is going to destroy that growth capability even more. So, yes, the investors of the world are going to go to the places where growth is greatest and where a return is possible, and that isn't here.
So you see, do you see a debt crisis looming?
Oh, yes. Yes, there is a debt crisis looming. The debt burden is already way, way too great. The interest costs of that are far larger than they've been in the past, and they'll continue to grow.
One of the things I was a bit surprised about a few years ago when we had the COVID lockdowns is I was very vociferous and very antagonistic to what the government told us and what they wanted us to do. I'm not sure you were quite the same.
I was opposed to lockdowns. They don't work.
Did you wear a mask?
I did wear a mask, yeah. I neither want to spread my own germs or receive other people's, and any small thing that...
And do you think it made any difference?
I've no idea. But I think it was a worthwhile thing to do, to try to minimise the spread of airborne particles of infection.
And how did you react? Because we came from a fairly libertarian background. How did you react to the government telling you where you could go, what you could do, who you could see, whether you could go to your wife's funeral, etc.? How did you? I mean, that had a huge effect on me because it brought home to me just how close it is that for the state to dominate everything.
Yeah, it disturbed me a great deal. The state shouldn't be able to constrain people's freedom in that way. And as I always am and always was with things like anti-terror legislation, thought that once they use powers like that, they'll keep them.
Mm.
And it's an ever-encroaching spread of the state into people's personal and private lives, controlling them, it doesn't get rolled back.
No, I found that absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, I agree. It was awful. And it resulted in some terrible things, didn't it? With people not able to visit their elderly relatives in care homes, not able to go to funerals and all of that kind of thing. Nasty.
Yep. I'd like to move on to something that might not interest everybody so much as the sort of geopolitical discussion, but we have a particular problem in the world at the minute, in that we have a council who are about to go into Section 21, which means that they're effectively not able to run anything. But I was horrified to see the other day, I don't know if you spotted this, that one of the things, if a council does go into Section 21, that the current rate cap of 5% on council tax goes out the window. And effectively, the council can impose a council tax of any figure they want. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. And that is definitely a worry.
Isn't it?
I mean, Wirral Council is both incompetent and bankrupt. And it's got to be exposed for that. I mean, it should go into bankruptcy. I know.
And corrupt, by the way.
What I see is the incompetence all around me. They spend money absurdly, you know, put millions into the Pyramids shopping scheme. Commercial activity, which no council should ever be allowed to be involved in. In West Kirby, where I live, they set up a poor quality cafe called the Sail Loft in a place that has a beautiful outlook, which ought to be the location for a high grade, well functioning restaurant business. It would attract very, very good custom. It was a poor cafe, badly run.
By the council.
By the council. Of course, they lost huge amounts of money, both building it, building an ugly extension to an ugly building, and then running it so badly that it lost hundreds of thousands of pounds. And now they're trying to let it to a commercial enterprise, and none in their right senses would take it on.
Mm.
The council must get rid of all of its ownership of anything that is involved in risk.
There's no reason why a council should own any assets, is there?
Nothing at all. No. They don't even need to own the buildings that they work in. The sole function of government of any kind is to protect its citizens. They should do only the things that they're statutorily required to do and nothing else.
So we're now in a situation whereby they have spent all the money.
Yeah.
They owe, as we've talked about before, in these lender option, borrower option loans, yeah, 170 million or whatever it is, a huge figure.
Mm.
And I think I saw the other day that the first 10% of, it might have been 5%, first 5%, I think it was, of everybody's council tax goes purely to pay the interest off on these loans. So I think that's something that, you know, it's a future council should challenge. Anyway, that's by the by. But how do you think Wirral residents are going to react to having spent all the money? They then come round and say, it's okay, we're going to charge you another 25% or 30% on your council tax.
Well, a lot of people are not going to be able to pay that, are they, is the first thing to be said. And absolutely everybody is going to be outraged by it, quite rightly. I don't know whether something as extreme as that is going to happen. What is more likely to happen is that they're going to take on other burdens, like the £40 million worth of borrowing they want to do from government, which just saddles them with future debt and future increases in council taxes.
Saddles us with future debt. It's because effectively they're acting on our behalf.
Absolutely. And all the money they spend is our money, as is the case with all government.
So going back to reform, I think reform our plan for Wirral Council, because that's the next elections that we can participate in, is in 2027, which is the next elections that are going to be on Wirral. Our plan is to stand 66 councillors in Wirral Council on a very positive platform of what we're going to do with it. If, let's just supposing that I persuaded you by that time to have a more sympathetic attitude to reform than you have now, and I asked you, what would you do in that situation? What would you say?
Well, I wouldn't be standing as a reformer.
No, I know. I'm joking. But you can just tell us what we should do. How do we solve the problem?
66 councillors, as you say. It's 22 wards.
Three in each.
Clear out 44 of the 66.
That's a great start. Yeah, absolutely.
A Department of Government Efficiency.
That's right, yeah. Malcolm's Doge.
Yes. Abolish all non-statutory expenditure by the council.
Right. Every so no more libraries, no more swimming pools.
No.
Yep.
Put them out to private contract. The council should be an enabler, not a provider. People want these facilities. They need these facilities, some of them, and they're entitled to those facilities. And They should pay for them where appropriate directly instead of paying for them in their council tax.
So, and expecting everybody else to pay for them in their council tax.
Quite. The people who use the facilities pay for the facilities in the same way as they do everything else in their shopping or they're going to a restaurant or whatever it is they do. The people who use the facilities pay for the facilities. They're not provided by a council which is incapable of providing them properly or well. They're provided by specialists in that field who do it because they know it and understand that business.
You mentioned an enabling council, and I think this is the key, because, and when you actually analyse it, much of what the council do is enabling. Because at the moment, what they do is they set contracts for everything that, you know, it's very rare for you ever to come in contact, direct contact with a council worker. It's somebody who's working for BIFA if they're picking your bin up, or a care home if they're looking after you. It's all contracts, isn't it? And the council, it seems to be, are not very good at setting contracts.
No.
And so we've got rid of 22 councils. What do we do with the 6,000 employees that they've currently got?
Well, quite a lot of those should go as well, shouldn't they? Buying is a skill, and it requires people with the capability, training and experience to do it. And it seems that the council do that badly. Procurement as a whole is very much a skill. Drawing up contracts and putting the processes out to tender is a very specialised business, and you need to understand how you do it. What governments of all kinds, national and local, do is shift all their personnel around all the time, so they know nothing about what they're doing generally. They don't know how to evaluate tenders which they're receiving or the quality of the businesses which are providing their bids. So they inevitably end up with lots of poor suppliers and with contracts which are not well enforceable, and they fail to enforce them anyway.
So would it not be better in that case that rather than getting the council even to set the contracts directly, that you outsourced the capability to set the contracts to a specialist who could do it?
That's right.
Who could set the contracts, then monitor them and so on. So, what do we do with the 6,000 employees?
Well, hopefully some more.
And what do they do currently?
Well, I don't know what they do currently. I found within my own sector, within the fire service, that lots of people did non-existent things. Mm. They occupied themselves with what were alleged to be jobs, and they weren't. You could dispense with those departments or those roles, and it made no difference.
Yeah.
But what has to be done, in my view, is that procurement and contract management should be done by specialists. Mm. That would be private companies, and hopefully some of that 6,000 would be employed in that process and would be taught to do the job properly.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose the one thing you have to say is that there are a certain number of statutory liabilities that the council has got to do. I mean, one of them, for example, being education, which is one I always come back to. Mm. At the moment, we've got a local education authority who controls roughly half, I think, of the schools in the world.
Yeah.
The rest of them have got academy status. Now, what I would do is to say to them, you've all got to have become academies. Got to appoint your own governors from the locality, et cetera, and close the local education authority altogether. Is that feasible in terms of the statutory requirements that the council's got to follow?
It's something, again, that we agree on. You shouldn't have a local education authority. Has no function. The schools should run themselves as academies. I'm pretty disturbed at the moment that the government are proposing to restrict the freedom of academies.
Absolutely.
Whereas they should be entirely free to run their own establishments, and parents should be entirely free to choose the schools that they send their children to. The local education authority doesn't perform a useful function as far as I'm concerned, and it should be closed down. Whether it has statutory functions which prevent it from being closed down, that's possible, and you have to change the law to achieve that. But at the moment, it's simply a burden that shouldn't be there.
Mm. And much of the overspend in the council is related to, again, statutory things that they're required to do for adult social care and for child care, which, again, as I say, they're all outsourced at the moment. Do you see there's any way that we can get that kind of bill down?
I don't have the knowledge to be able to say that. But, yes, I understand that a very large part of the overspend by the council has been on adult social care. And you see things which are probably very marginal in the overall cost, which seem to be strange, like a requirement that the people are transported by taxis backwards and forwards to the places where they need to be all of the time. And there seems to be a lot of superimposition of rules which they've come up with because there's been an event that's happened, and so then they apply a blanket to everybody, a costly overhead because of one thing that has been unfortunate or has embarrassed them or damaged an individual or something of that kind. It's a bureaucratic functioning of the process. And again, the only way I can think that gets improved or eradicated is by running the thing by contract, by private providers.
Yeah, sort of, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a bit of involvement with the council in terms of mainly things that I've been trying to fight against. We have mounted the 20 mile an hour campaign last year, I think, as you know. I watched the council meeting the other night, and the same sort of thing came up again when they were imposing an active travel plan on certain areas and putting cycle lanes, which have been into various places. Now, in both the 20 mile an hour thing and this active travel thing, the council were obliged, again, by statute, to go to consultation of the public. In both cases, they did. In both cases, 90% of the public said, I don't want it. I don't want 20 mile an hour zones. I don't want bus lanes. And in both cases, the council, the eight members of the 8-3 on the CECT committee said, no, we're going to have them anyway.
Yeah.
Now, the way the statute is written, it says that the council has to have a consultation, which, by the way, are expensive and we pay for.
Yeah.
They have to have this consultation and they have to take account of it. That's it's language like that. They have to take account of the result. When 90-odd% of people say they don't want something, is it reasonable to say that the council are taking account of the result when they then just push it through anyway?
Yeah, of course it's not. It's an affront, isn't it, to
Absolutely.
The public who have supposedly been consulted. They haven't been consulted at all, have they? A lot of money has been spent putting out a question and collecting stuff back, and then it's ignored.
Mm.
And they claim that they're taking account of these things by saying, well, I disagree with it. That's not taking account, is it?
No, it's not. So, in these circumstances, are you sure there's nothing I can do to persuade you to stand for reform in the elections in 2027, Mark?
Well, I think you might have noticed. Not a chance.
Nevertheless, thank you very much for coming in today. I hope we've been able to trigger a few people, and I wish you well.
Thanks, Ken. I wish you well, too, but not reform.
I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.